"What about snakes?" asked Ellen's brother Alex, his eyes shining. "And death is in the garden, awaiting till we pass, for the crate is in the drainpipe, the cobra in the grass." "Well, some suggest tying a light bandage around the bitten limb, a few inches above the bite, and sucking the wound. If I told you more, you'd be sick." "What about fever?" asked Nellie. "Oh, in fever districts, they use opium against disease." After this interesting digression, the conversation lulled a little till Alec again brought up the subject of wild animals, in this instance, tigers. "Well, sometimes a tiger shoot was held at Christmas. Once, villagers told my father, 'Sahib, there's tigers here.' They caught a bullock calf and tied it up overnight. They built a platform in a tree and we all climbed up a rough ladder. We sat there in silence for hours, hardly daring to breathe. There'd be a rattle and we'd think, 'Here it is,' but it was only a peacock or a monkey. Well, then the tiger came along. Daddy shot it, a tigress with two cubs. Oh, she was absolutely beautiful. We sent the pelt to Mama's sister in Rome." Little Alex's cheeks were flushed in the candlelight and his eyelids were beginning to droop. "I know, Alex, it's time to be awa to your bed," Ellen Baxter said. The company disbanded, thanking their hostesses for an excellent evening. After that, James Innes called round to visit Kate and Lizzie on a regular basis, learning all he could about India, the country, its climate, its people. By now, he had set his heart firmly on becoming a missionary. And Kate made no secret of the fact that she would be returning to Darjeeling after her graduation. It was hardly a match made in heaven, thought Lizzie ruefully, but it was a match nonetheless, marred only by Kate's staunch defence of the right of all people to worship in the way they saw best, Christian or otherwise. On this, they ultimately agreed to differ. James, secretly, was convinced that once away from the liberal influence of the university, he could wean her off what he saw as her more extreme ideas. The autumn term resumed and the students returned to their studies. Lizzie and Kate had less time to spend in outings together, but Kate encouraged her cousin to help Ellen with her charitable work whenever the household duties were discharged. Neither girl had time to enter much in the journal. The new year came and went quietly. In Bengal, so Kate said, the new year, or Nababarsha, fell in April and was celebrated with kite flying, recitations, dancing and games. People cleaned and decorated their houses, drew rangolis in front of their homes and made designs with powdered rice in their floors, in the midst of which they placed an earth pot with mango leaves and water, marked with a red and white swastika. People bathed in the river, and women wore white saris with a red border and put flowers in their hair. Lord Ganesh, the elephant god of new beginnings, was worshipped. Lizzie's idea of Hogmanay was thoroughly Scottish. She cleaned and swept their own little home on New Year's Eve in the Scottish way, and set out a tray with whisky, sherry and black bun. Kate, not to be outdone, put her heir's little Lord Ganesh up on the table to supervise the proceedings. "James had better not catch a day in that," said Lizzie. They both laughed. When the church bells chimed in 1901, they raised their glasses to the new year and laid to rest the old year that had seen out Charlotte Macombie so cruelly. Just over 3 weeks later, Queen Victoria died at Osborne House, her eldest son, Prince Albert Edward, succeeding her as King Edward VII. The old Queen's funeral was heard on the 2nd of February at St George's Chapel, Windsor Castle, on a bitterly cold day, after 2 days of solemn lying in state. She had ruled Britain and her empire for so long, neither Kate nor Lizzie could imagine life without her. Surprisingly, the world continued as normal. If 1900 had passed quickly, it seemed to Lizzie that 1901 went by even faster. As a hobby, she had taken up crocheting since the price of cotton thread was falling. Soon she had crafted chair backs for all their furniture. Kate had presented her with an ivory hook to encourage her. Some folk called crochet poor man's lace, but Queen Victoria herself had learned crochet and had passed the time when Kate occasionally stayed over at the poorhouse. They had a visit from the sweep Albert Davidson. Mr. Davidson worked in second-hand undertaker's clothes, black from head to foot, and top hat and frock coat. His rounds started at 7 in the morning and finished when darkness came. He was a bandy-legged man with a low, slung rear, a jaw to strike flints off, and hands like shovels. Albert arrived with his rods, shields, brushes and sacks, accompanied by his son, a miniature version of the father, but with brown and ruly hair instead of a hat and a liberal peppering of freckles. "Is the brush shoot yet?" Albert Sr. would shout, and from the street below Albert Jr. would cry out, "Nay yet, da." Kate had thoroughly investigated the necessity and procedure of chimney sweeping prior to her arrival from India and had given Lizzie a serious talk about the dangers of soot accumulating in the flue. A clean flue, she lectured, meant more heat and less smoke. Lizzie had also been instructed by her cousin to stop using her mother's method of chimney cleaning, which consisted of screwing up old newspapers, ramming these into the chimney as far as they'd go and setting them alight. The arrival of the sweep, however, entailed a great deal of preparatory work. The entire room had to be cleared, the carpet lifted, and dust sheets spread over everything that couldn't be moved. After Albert left, however, Lizzie made a resolution to forget Kate's instructions and to carry on setting the flue on fire as before. A little danger would be far less effort than all the turmoil of moving the furniture. As far as she could see, the only good thing about soot was that cleaned your teeth in the morning. There were times, she thought, when Kate didn't need to know everything. Being a housekeeper companion involved a delicate balance of relationship between friend and servant. The girls had visited the beach and had great fun changing their clothes in the confines of a bathing machine to the sound of a brass band playing in the background. Together they had collected pebbles and shells, and both had later attempted to draw and label their finds. Kate assured Lizzie that the fresh air was very good for her, and an antidote to consumption, though there was a dismal graveyard close at hand where many of the gravestones displayed a fouled anchor, indicating the loss of a drowned sailor or ferryman. Some years ago in Davana, an overloaded ferry travelling across the Rothery had snapped its ropes in a strong current caused by several days of rain. The boat had capsized with a heavy loss of life. On Kate's rare free days, the cousins would ignore Nicholas Hunter's general store and go shopping near the harbour in streets where virtually everything might be bought and sold for a few pence. This was so different to the bazaars in Darjeeling that Kate noted down details of these visits. Many vendors are hawkers, but some have fixed weekly stalls or standings. They trawl the area with donkey carts or barrows, or even carrying trays in their heads. Fishwives carry their wares and creels on their backs. Weekends are the busiest time when workmen have their pay. At night the area is lit by candles, gas jets or naphtha flames, and in autumn by the fires of chestnuts being roasted. I love the noise and the variety, and the traders calling out their wares. Chestnuts, a penny a score. 3 a penny, Davana herrings. Buckies to bile, a penny a lot. Buy your neeps here. I can understand the Scots tongue now, and everything that Lizzie and Ellen say, unless they talk very fast to each other, and then I am lost. Father speaks hardly any Scots now at all. I am forgetting most of the Hindi I ever knew. Outside their open-fronted shops, bakers in white aprons bellow, "Rolls for sale! Fresh rolls!" And in the swarming streets, hawkers sell saucepans, buttons, crockery, old shoes, cutlery, trays, flowers, handkerchiefs, scarves, umbrellas, snuff and shirts. But if it rains for a week or more, these traders are driven to near starvation. In January and February, Lizzie takes a tram to the harbour area for fish. Spring sees the vendors selling flowers. In June, folk buy new potatoes from the hawkers, but we are supplied with these by Uncle Henry. In July, Lizzie sometimes buys cherries and soft fruit here, though we prefer to cycle together to Migri Farm and gather wild rasps in the summer. In September, the vendors sell apples, but Uncle Henry sends us to the windfalls from his own orchard. At Christmas, Lizzie buys oranges, and for decoration, holly and ivy are plentiful enough in Provost Buchan Woods. Andrew Duckett usually gives us a small cut fir tree from there.